Hi guys, Alicia Oxy from True Detective, Life Sentence, Ballers, Bad Sister.
Hello, Brian, Nico, Dustin, Mike. I'm really loving that everybody is revisiting season one since this season is banging. What I'll say is, don't go out there.
They've conquered the big screen. Now, get ready for the spin-off sure to send chills down your spine. It's Nico, Brian, Mike, and Dustin in Don't Go Out There, the series.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Don't Go Out There podcast. Just want to thank all our fans and listeners. Really appreciate the support. You guys are awesome. Before we get into tonight's review, just want to give a quick shout out to our website, don'tgooutthere.com. Everything about our podcast is on the website. All of our episodes and interviews, if you want to check those out. We've done some incredible interviews in the past. Go check them out there in a specific tab by themselves so you don't have to scroll through hundreds of episodes on Apple or Spotify, etc. We also have our store if you want to grab a shirt, a mouse pad, a hat, all that good stuff. We'd love to see your pictures, you know, rep your favorite podcast. And Chan's Etsy page is also attached if you want to grab a Tumblr. All of our social media links are on there as well. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok. Like us, subscribe us, follow us, all that good stuff. And the last thing I want to shout out on our website is our Patreon. We call it Blood Donors. We have the traditional monthly reoccurring kind. If you want to support us, help us pay the bills, as we say. Or if there's a movie you want us to review, that option is available as well. Just check out our website, don'tgooutthere.com. Also, if you haven't noticed, we've recently joined the Believe Network. So there's some ads on our program now. But if you want ad-free content, go check us out on Blood Donors. The ad-free episodes will be available there. We appreciate your support. We hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back, everybody, to DGOT, the series. I'm really excited to conclude True Detective Season 1 this evening with my brothers, Brian and Dustin. This has been a great choice, Brian. I mean, I knew from the get-go that this would be a great series just from the way you spoke on it, the online reviews I've seen, and the 2 stars. This has been a great series. I'm really excited to review episodes 5, 7, and 8, excuse me. And, Brian, you just got any opening thoughts before we jump into it?
First of all, it's kind of crazy how close to modern-day reality this cult of powerful people is, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, anyway. But I mean, I get it if you say maybe you're disappointed a little bit with these two as a finale. And I get it if you say maybe that, I mean, episode 7 is maybe a touch slower, but I think it's very necessary. I don't think it's boring at all, despite all of the dialogue in this episode. I think they absolutely nailed it with landing on these 2 episodes. And again, I think I've said this before, but I'm very glad that the series had such a buildup for you. It still landed for you. It still hit.
I liked episode 7 a little better than 8, honestly.
Yeah, you like the slower. You guys like the slower episodes.
And 8's not bad by any means, but when we get to the end, I just wanted a little more, I think.
Yeah.
But 7, like I told you, when me and you were texting after I watched the season in full, like whenever Arrow reveals, mm-hmm. like he's the killer and all that, like that was like one of those old Jigsaw reveals. I was like, oh, shit. I loved it. So, yeah, I'm excited to break it down.
Yeah, so that's how I am, Nico. I think these 2 episodes are good. I mean, this whole series, this whole season has been just top-notch stuff from production to writing to acting. Like, it's been phenomenal. The score is incredible. But for me, Brian, episode 7 is a little slower, but I think the tension's there. And, like, seeing them, I enjoy seeing puzzles be put together. Like, I enjoy the detective aspect of what episode 7 brought, how they're getting closer. They're onto something. The boys are back together, you know? And my issue with episode 8, which we'll get into, is like you said, Nico, like I wanted more. I wanted it to be more dramatic. I wanted, you know, I came away a little unfulfilled with the ending, but it tied up nicely. Like, I will say that. Like, it's fine in how it all played out. I just wanted a little bit more. But overall, yeah, really, really damn good season.
Yeah, and I'll touch on some things that I would have liked to have seen at the end when we get to it.
Gotcha. Well, I'm doing the scene by scene this week. I wanted to, since I was the only one who had seen this and picked it, I'm very interested to hear what you have to say going throughout. So is there anything else before I get started? Our penultimate episode of True Detective Season 1, Episode 7, After You've Gone. Here we go. Picking up where we left off in episode 6, we open with a modern day Russ and Marty at a bar. Both are definitely hesitant to start conversation as Marty gets in the first jab, saying Father Time has a way with us all, and that Russ must have really pissed him off because he doesn't exactly look good. The kind of age slander I get in the DGOT chat all the time, but we'll leave that alone. Russ explains he spent the last 8 years functional, but hammered, and how he also returned to Alaska to work fishing boats. He finally tells Marty why they are there, and it's to pay back debts, and that he found evidence that links the murders at Lake Charles to Dora Lange's and how it's being covered up. At first, Marty not only says no, but says if he was drowning, he'd basically let him. But like someone calling Marty McFly a chicken, Russ convinces this Marty with talks of paying off his debt to the way things went down in 95, and they head to Russ' secret storage shed. And for all this talk about Russ being a suspect and tailing him to find out what he's hiding, Russ and Marty are able to talk pretty freely and access this non-locked shed pretty easily without a tail, by the way. Here, Russ shows Marty 2 years' worth of evidence connecting an immense amount of disappearances related to the Tuttle schools and tells a 2010 story about tracking down a now prostitute named Toby who attended one of the schools with Mary Fontenot and talks about people in animal masks taking pictures of them. Marty calls him out on being a conspiracy theorist and sounding crazy until he sees even more evidence connecting the cases to the man with the scars and the spaghetti monster with green ears. Rust finally tells him that he needs to help on the inside with Marty's connections, and Marty ends the set of scenes asking point blank, what happened to Billy Lee Tuttle? To which Rust replies that there is no way getting around the fact that there's something Marty needs to look at.
All right, starting off with some extremely basic review talk. The old school jukebox at the beginning in the bar, you know, zooming in on it, it brought back some nostalgia. I remember going, you know, out to eat, picking some songs on the jukebox. Really good times. I want to compliment Matthew as Rust yet again. I think his look is incredible. His eyes, the lack of color in his face. He became Russ Cole, and you can tell how much he put into the character. And more exceptional review talk, which I'm sure will merit another mean YouTube comment. The chemistry between Matthew and Woody is exceptional throughout, but this conversation at the bar I thought was one of their best of the season. Marty holds a grudge like no other. Throwing a drowning man a barbell, what? Outrageous behavior. I don't know what you're talking about, Brian. I can't really fault Marty for pulling his gun out, but damn, the obsession this man Rust has with this case. He's one of my favorite characters we've ever reviewed and I've seen in any kind of film or cinema or like TV shows. Minor nitpick, but Rust doesn't show enough urgency to close the rolling door to his storage shed, I thought. He would want to close that a little bit quicker. But that's also a nitpick that I'll touch on later on. A nitpick with a nitpick. This section of the episode is rather difficult to take notes on, but that doesn't mean it's bad. Russ kills it in his interviews with Toby, the child from one of Tuttle's school, and then showing Marty all the evidence and theories he's acquired. I thought it was a really good opening.
Yeah, I think it's a great open with Russ and Marty. Like, it's quiet. It's kind of awkward. Excuse me. It's kind of awkward and very realistic how I feel like that conversation would go. Also, great line from Marty about the, you know, Father Time having his way with us all. Looks like you must have fixed him up. Like, that's a great zinger. Another one, like you mentioned, when he said, if you're drowning, I'd throw you a fucking barbell. Like, because we hear often, you know, I wouldn't piss on you if you're on fire to put you out. Right. Like, this is a great, fresh take on that. I'm probably going to use it. I'm glad we finally get a look at Russ' storage shed. But, buddy, it doesn't exactly make him look innocent or sane at first glance. Like, you open up that storage shed, and like you said, Nico, he wasn't in a hurry to shut the door. Anyone else sees that, they're like, this guy's fucking crazy. When I first saw Russ' interaction with Johnny Joni, I couldn't help but think of McConaughey and Jared Leto in Dallas Buyers Club. Like, it's unrelated, it's irrelevant, but I wrote it down anyway. Like, that's where my mind went. But anyway, really solid open. I love seeing the boys back together.
Yeah, and you mentioned it was hard to take notes because, I mean, like you said, it's so dialogue heavy. So, but it's needed. It's needed dialogue. It's needed. I'm glad you guys liked this episode. I was worried you wouldn't like it because it was slow. But we flash forward to Marty visiting Maggie's new house where we find out it's been months since they've spoken and years since they've seen each other. They get us caught up on the state of the kids and everything over coffee, and Marty tells her he's going to help Rust. We flash back to the storage unit where Russ reveals that he broke into Tuttle's house in Baton Rouge, to which Tuttle never reported, by the way, and that's because that's where he retrieved photos that depicted children in the forest wearing antlers and being bound. He also reveals that he found a videotape and hands Marty a flask before asking him to watch it. This tape shows the ritualistic rape and murder of Marie Fontenot. This is all the convincing Marty needs to agree to help, and in a great exchange, tells Rust he shouldn't have that tape, to which he replies, no one should. We flash back, well, forward, to Maggie's apartment again to continue the conversation between her and Marty, where she straight up asks him if he came there to say goodbye. Marty tells her thank you for being such a good mother, never answers the question, and for everything, and then leaves. The two head to Hart's PI offices, and the two begin setting up the investigation. They briefly discuss their personal lives the past 8 years before showing some inner cuts of Hart using his connections and sweet talk to gain access to old case files. Hart finds a distant relative of Reggie Ledoux who they question, but only really reiterates seeing the man with the scars. They also visit Dolores Jackson, who they found on tax records, that worked for Billy Lee Tuttle's father. They lie about doing research for a family tree to her niece, where they find out that Tuttle had a secret family and a grandson with a scarred face named Childress, who gained the scars through the abuse of his father. She has an anxiety attack where she brings up Carcosa, and the two are asked to leave, and the next set of scenes is the ending.
I think the show does a great job of aging Maggie in a believable way, and props to her and Marty for being cordial after their divorce. It's very evident that Marty still hurt from the experience between Maggie and Rust, and I think Woody Harrelson did a great job portraying the hurt. I thought it was funny when I was like, you know, Rust, I 100% believe you lost your mind, brother. But I think he might be a top 10, maybe a top 5 character like I've ever watched on TV or, you know, film. You know, a video is horrific when someone can't rewatch it when showing it to another person. It's disgusting content, and it's horrific how realistic this kind of stuff is. And I think that's, you know, and that's what Brian mentioned when he said, like, this show, like, scares him because it's so real.
Yeah.
Great acting by Woody Harrelson in his outrage scene after watching Marie Fontenot's video. I thought Woody did a great job there as well. Holy shit, what a life transformation by Marty. Fish, go home, dating a Filipino girl. Hell, I can't fault him, though. Lumpia and adobo, it goes crazy. If you know, you know, my brother. Detective Lutz, J.D. Evermore, he looked really familiar, and I peeped his IMDb, and holy shit, he's been in a lot of huge movies and shows. The Walking Dead, this, Walker, Texas Ranger, The Guardian, Django, Dallas Buyers Club, 12 Years a Slave, and friend of the show, Joe Lynch's Suitable Flesh. More good detective work in this set of scenes from Rust and Marty interviewing Jimmy Ledoux and Miss Dolores. And I thought it was great acting by Carol Sutton as Dolores. I thought she was captivating talking about Carcosa. That's all I got. Go ahead, Dustin.
So to me, it sucks seeing Marty talk to Maggie because you hear how out of touch he is with his daughter's lives. Like that was tough to me. He's not a part of any of their lives anymore. That's hard. Also tough seeing the villain of the show, Maggie, just in general. She has some nerve to ask Marty how Rust is. Don't ask your ex-husband about the well-being of the man you fornicated with, harlot. Anyway. Sick shit with, you know, what all Rust found in Tuttle's home. Execute him immediately and publicly, but I guess that was taken care of. I don't know why, but it cracked me up seeing Rust standing with his face 2 inches from the storage unit door when Marty was watching the video. Why did he do that? Like he was standing with his nose like he was in timeout. That was funny to me. And here's a question I have for y'all. Would you believe Rust when he said he didn't kill Tuttle? Like, would there even be a little bit of a doubt? He's already admitting he broke into multiple of his houses and finding what he found. I would understand killing him. So would you guys at least, you know, question, did he do it?
I mean, I would question him because I would think I would not blame him if he did kill him. I would be like, okay, well, I get you why you killed him. I just fucking watched this video. Like, I get it. But, you know, if he told me no, I would believe him. Would I think so, though? Yeah.
Yeah, even after he told me no, I think I'd still be like, he probably did have something to do with his mysterious death. But again, you know, Marty is the perfect person to confide that information in because we saw him just pull the trigger, no questions asked back, you know, a few episodes ago. So I think he would be an understanding person to tell. I got a good chuckle when Marty was so thrown off by Rust asking him a personal question. Like, that was great writing. It was like, you know, I don't think I remember you ever asking me a personal question. That was good shit there. And then I like the, you know, the look at their lives when they were catching each other up about what's been going on. That's really good work, how we got the cuts to what they'd really been up to. Yeah. And then, man, I was going to play baseball, ride bulls. You end up becoming something you never intended. I guess you never even really know why. Shit, I felt that. Like, I think about that often. I find myself all the time asking, how did I get this old and this far off my intended path? Like, that, I don't know why. That really resonated with me, though. But, oh, well, time marches on, brother. Anyway, I know if I was Marty, I'd be pissed I had to go through all those files by myself. Like, Rust is lucky that he wasn't allowed to go into the police station like that. That seems like a fucking nightmare. He did have a great line referring to the two detectives, called them fucking suck, the two dicks I spent last week with. Like, I laughed. That was great. That was great. Then when Dolores was talking about Carcosa, it gave me He Who Walks Behind the Rose vibes. Like, that's, I was thinking, okay, this is a tie-in. This is Children of the Corn. But anyway, this is a really good set of scenes that, you know, things are really ramping up. They're on the right track.
And I just want to interject something here. I mean, it's just a little thing about the set of scenes. The line where Maggie tells Marty that Audrey sold some paintings in New Orleans. Like, I found myself wishing Marty had kind of told Maggie or said that he was the one who bought them without anyone knowing. Like, just a small little dad thing I kind of wish would have been said. Like, I don't know. It's just, I think it would have added a lot without adding a lot, if that makes sense. Anyway.
That's fair. And I did like the, you know, his reply to that. It's like, oh, I need to buy one if I can afford one. It's like, that's him kind of portraying that he is proud of her no matter how far apart they've grown. Like, I appreciated that line.
Yeah, for sure. All right, here's the ending, guys. After what laughably appears to be like $3 in ones, Marty gives Dolores his niece. Like, if you slow it down and look, it really does. It made me laugh. It looks like three ones. But after that exchange at the bar later that evening, Marty reveals to Russ that he's discovered that it was then deputy, now sheriff, Steve Garassi.
I did. I just put his first name.
Played by the one and only Michael Harney as the one who originally investigated the Marie Fontenot case. Russ reveals he never did like that cocksucker, and the two agree to let Marty try to talk to him first since he's a people person. Marty suspects he's lying and tells Russ to get the jumper cables ready because the motherfucker is lying. Maggie shows up to the bar to talk to Rust, to which she tells him that she talked to Marty and the cops and attempts small talk, to which Rust will fucking have none of. She reveals her true intention is to find out if what they're up to will end up getting Marty hurt. Rust basically tells her to fuck off while also simultaneously giving her a compliment about classing the place up. Later that evening, Marty and Rust discuss more about the past at the investigation agency and why Marty quit. And Russ came back as the two get ready for the plot to unfold with Sheriff Steve. I just wrote Sheriff Steve that time because I didn't even want to say his fucking name.
Scuba Steve, damn Scuba you! Steve.
To which we get to see in real time after the cut. Russ interrupts Marty and Steve's conversation as the two hold him at gunpoint. We flash to Gilbo and Papania, who are also in the bayou, trying to find the burned up church that Russ mentioned. Unable to find the address, they stop by a cemetery to ask the caretaker for the location, who we might recognize from a few episodes ago, as Russ stopped to ask him the same thing. After the caretaker points them in the right direction, they drive off, failing to notice that the lower part of his face is heavily scarred. He mutters, "My family's been here a long, long time." And we zoom out to see the pattern that he's cutting into the grass resembles the familiar spiral triangle logo, and we fade to black.
All right, I wrote LOL at Fiona telling Russ it should worry him that Dolores made sense. But we all know by now that Russ has his issues. Marty, he backs his way into being Russ' pawn to set up the meeting with Garassi. And I just wrote, oh shit, Maggie is at Russ' bar. I'm interested to see where this goes, but it goes nowhere. And I love how throughout the entire show, Russ never answers any of Maggie's questions, really. He just kind of like plays it off and just tells her to like fuck off, like you said, Brian. I would love to ask Matthew in person about Russ and his fascination with circles in the show. Time is a flat circle. His life is a circle. I think that's really intriguing, in my opinion. I picked up on him, you know, mentioning circles so often.
Well, you know, God, he did convince me that the Earth is not a circle; it's flat. So,
yeah, I remember you saying that. God, I'd love to be on this fishing boat in the bayou. You know, completely off topic. Louisiana is top notch fishing. I'm super jealous, but I don't have a clue how Garassi isn't more suspicious of Marty. Out of the blue, he asks to hang out, and he keeps bringing up the Fontenot girl case over and over. Like, how is he not more suspicious from the get go? Incredible nature shots as we transition from on the boat to the detectives looking for the church in the country. And like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, my first watch through of this series, I had the huge holy shit moment when the Errol Childress reveal happens. And he says, you know, I know the whole coast and my family's been there a long time. I thought that reveal was fantastic. And I love the song playing as the episode ends. I thought it was a damn fine episode. One of my favorites.
There you go.
So Marty playing golf with Sheriff Steve there is good stuff. It continues to weave this web. Then Maggie has got some nerve to go to Russ's bar. Now, he did have a great line when he said, get out of here, you're classing the place up. But I don't know how a woman of her character can class any place up. That's besides the point. Absolutely perfect shot of the swamp leading up to Marty and the sheriff on the boat. I know, Brian, you had to appreciate those nature shots. I wish they'd have lingered a little bit longer.
I knew I wasn't going to get out of that without catching something.
And it was beautiful, though. Anyway, I fucking love when Marty said, I ain't going to ask you. He is, and then Rust had his iron drawn. Hell yeah, turn up the tension, brother. Like, that was awesome. He's on the boat the whole time. Loved it. Seeing Errol Moen here, though, like, it did just make me wonder, how the fuck did Rust not make the connection when he talked to him earlier? Like, he didn't even have a little suspicion when they see his fat ass with burn marks on his face, and they talked to him directly a few episodes back. I know they addressed that in the finale, and I'll get to that when we get to it, but when I'm seeing it here, that's just what I was thinking. It's like, come on, you were face-to-face with this guy. But anyway, it's another great episode that sets us up nicely for the season finale.
Well, they did do a good job of distracting Rust. I mean, they had, I think Marty ought to get a call or something like as soon as he saw him and pull him away. And I don't even think we saw the guy with scars. So I don't think, you know, maybe he did.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say that, Brian, the show did a good job of kind of like putting him in the shadows where you couldn't see his face, like where the sun was shining on. I couldn't see his face that well.
Yeah, I couldn't either. But I'm just thinking realistically, like if his face is scarred the fuck up, like he's basically got a beard of scars. And so I don't know that even, you know, if I was faced, because he was pretty close to him. He was pretty face to face with him. I don't know how he didn't see him, regardless of the lighting, regardless of what they say in the next episode about he had dirt on his face. I think because I don't know. I just think he would have been able to see at least a little bit of scarring. And that should have, as a detective, raised some suspicion.
Yeah, especially someone like Rust. But I feel you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody have any fun facts on this episode?
I do not, but I'll go ahead and say this. So I've been doing the episode by episode rating. I gave this one a 9. I think it's a damn good episode as well.
Yeah, it got a 9.2 rating on IMDb, I believe. The only fact I had was about Michael Harney, who played Garachi. Legend of the business. He was in NYPD Blue forever, played Sarah Michelle Gellar's dad in Buffy, Steve on Deadwood, Ocean's 13, fucking great franchise, by the way, and probably most known recently for playing Sam Healy on Orange is the New Black. And like we said on the review, Bill Mercer on Nico's favorite movie, The Iron Claw.
Which you haven't watched yet for some reason.
for no reason.
What?
I gave you the digital code months ago, like 2 months ago. Watch the damn movie. It's the best fucking movie ever made other than The Godfather.
But all I hear is just how sad it is, and I'm just like, oh, I don't feel like being sad at the moment. Like,
it's not sad the whole movie. I mean, it's sad, but it's not like gonna make you cry the whole movie. It's just like the last 5 minutes.
They just turned it off after the wedding. Great movie.
Okay.
Just turn it off.
Sounds
right
good.
Then.
I'll turn it off at the wedding. All right, sounds good.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code POD to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code POD at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code POD.
All right, anywho. So you guys are ready for episode 8?
Let's do it.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, our finale, episode 8, Form and Void.
Here we go.
We open up back at the fucked up swamp house where we see who now we know as Errol Childress hovering over his very dead father, Billy, who is strapped to a bed and mentions him probably keeping another day in this heat. He exits to the main house where we meet someone who is at least half related, Betty, and the two have a very disturbing exchange, changing from British accents to animal abuse, and discuss how long it's been since he, quote, made flowers on her. And if it wasn't fucked up enough, she proceeds to sit on his lap and is fingered while he asks her to tell him about Grandpa, to which she starts to talk about being raped in the cane fields before we are very, very, very happily greeted with a cut away from this fucking scene back to Marty, Rust, and Sheriff Garacci on the boat. On the boat, the two force Sheriff Garacci to watch the videotape of Marie Fontenot's rape and murder. Fucked up by the content, Steve confesses that Sheriff Childress was in charge of the investigation and dropped the case back in 1990. We briefly cut to see Errol painting a school and disgustingly checking out one of the little girls and boys before being approached about lunch from one of the teachers. Before cutting back to the boat, where the two tell Garacci that they are going to frame him for the videotape and that all the findings are ready to be sent to all lawyers and TV stations if he decides to swing his dick. Steve still decides to swing some dick on the situation, and Rust informs his sniper via hand signal to send him a message. We are shown bar owner and Rust friend Robert Dumain as the sniper on the grassy knoll, and that's the end of this set of scenes.
Do you think he's right. also the sniper on the grassy knoll that took out JFK?
Kind of looks like him. I don't know.
First off, Brian, hell of a job getting this episode started. I saw Dustin over there doing the D-Generation X. I was
I thought Road Dogg was in the ring.
Yeah, I was ready to get fired up. Well, he lives close to Road Dogg, so he might have got some.
I see him at least twice a year.
Hell yeah, brother! Errol Childress is fucking horrifying. I hate to say this, but he just has like that look of a killer, which is unfair. But man, the man's got a sketchy looking face. Looking at Errol and his wife in their house, they definitely give me Piggly Wiggly vibes. Take that for what you will, with all due respect. Holy shit.
Damn.
Piggly Wiggly vibes is right up there with Circle K teeth and Jiffy Store feet now.
Damn.
Respectfully, of course. If you do shop at the Piggly Wiggly, that's all you have available.
Respectfully, of course.
Holy shit. Betty Childress is Joan from Hereditary. No wonder Brian likes this show so much. I love how serious Rust is as he forces Garacci to watch the video. Minor nitpick, though, Rust's mustache bothers me when he doesn't look sickly. And I'm going to touch on the look a little more. Errol disgusts me as he stares at the children playing, knowing what his intentions are. I will compliment Glenn Fleshler. He does a phenomenal job in the role. My, how the tables have turned, huh, Garacci? Gave my man Rust hell for years, and now he's playing you like a fiddle. It's painful to see that Maserati getting destroyed. I know only Dustin has the funds to do something outrageous like that, but this is a fun opening.
You make me sick. You know, and I didn't have this in my notes, but you said it, so I'm going to piggyback off of it. His mustache irritated me, too, because when they're in the car and he's turned the right way, like it looked like the corner of his mustache wasn't attached. Like it looked like a fake mustache to me. It may have been a real mustache. I don't know, but it bothered me. So,
well, I wonder if he's still shaving in that little bitty piece of glass that was on the wall by the air conditioner. If he's shaving in that, then, I mean, you can't blame that dude.
Well, no, I mean, that's not going to affect. Like, it literally looked like it wasn't attached to his upper lip in the corner. I don't know. Bothered me. Anyway, this is, without a doubt, the most disturbing open that we've had yet. Oh, yeah. This fat fuck is just creepy as hell. And he's talking to his daddy, who's tied to the bed in this redneck fuck shack. Just yuck. Do not like it. Then he goes into the main house, which I swear I've seen before on an episode of Hoarders on TLC. And he develops a British accent all of a sudden. Like, what the fuck's going on? I did borrow something from these inbred fucks, though. I will now be referring to Bumpin' Uglies as making flowers.
God.
Yeah. This is nauseating. I mean, when she's sitting on his lap and you mentioned it, like, he goes to, you know, he starts finger blasting her. Ugh. God, I got uneasy. Anyway.
Thankfully, about Grandpa.
Yeah, what the fuck is that? Yeah. Thankfully, we do get back to Rust and Marty on the boat, though, because that storyline is much more appealing to me. And it finishes up incredibly. Great acting here by the sheriff. You know, hats off to Michael Harney. Just top-notch stuff. I like how we see Errol painting the school here. It makes the revelation later, like, even better. You kind of put things together, I think, about the green ears. Yeah. Marty and Rust showing their hand with the sheriff is great. Like, they thought this all the way through, and they've got all the bases covered. Love that. I love the sniper touch. It shows them that they're not fucking around. And, yeah, like you said, it was painful to see that Maserati get destroyed like that, but it was awesome. Because it's easy to say you have a sniper, but when the sniper starts shooting, it's like, oh, shit, okay, they're not lying. This is a great opening scene that really didn't start out the way, you know, it didn't start out that way, but it developed nicely. It went from disgusting to enthralling. I'm all in.
Back at the office, the two are examining the total family tree and going back through the case files when Marty makes the case-breaking discovery of the season and notices that a house in Dora Lang's neighborhood was freshly painted green in one of the pictures, and then connects that with the green-eared spaghetti monster children description from before. As they drive to the house, the two finally have the discussion about Maggie's situation and their relationship since the start. They get to the house and contact the original owner at the time, Lily Hill. She remembered that people painted her house back in 94 and one of them had a scarred face. Checking her husband's past tax returns, they identify the company as Childress and Sons Maintenance, as the two also connect them with the disappearances of women and children. They find an address to a house on Highway 27 South. Before setting off, Russ is shown instructing Domain. I don't fucking know. Instructing his bar friend, the shooter on the grassy fucking knoll, to deliver the packages with evidence to the authorities in case he doesn't return within 24 hours. We then flash to a diner where Marty is meeting with Detective Papagna, telling him that they were on something big, and asks if he wants the call when the time comes.
All right, I don't have a lot for this set of scenes, but I do want to ask y'all a question, and I want to hear y'all's opinion for real. But does Rust in the beginning set of the scenes not seem to have his edge, like his personality that makes him, like when he's first asking, like Woody Harrelson, like when they're in his office and like talking, like I don't know, Rust didn't seem to have that, like that Rust edge to him, and it I don't know, it stuck out to me. Maybe it's just because he looked too healthy.
I mean, he's had a rough fucking decade since they left, and I think they did a really good job of giving him an arc to where, yeah, he's not the same person as he was, and he has softened up. I mean, just asking the personal questions he never asked 10 years ago, I mean, that's something right there in a personality trait they didn't have before. So I think they did a great job with that.
I agree. And, you know, you said he's had a hard decade. I mean, that's what fucking a succubus will do to you. It'll send everything downhill.
Jesus Christ.
I do think that it was a good job to show – it was a good job to show how Russ, like when he's in the zone, when he's in the like locked in, it's like he gets a different personality develops versus when he's just talking about something casually or in passing, or he's being interrogated with something. Yeah. You know, he's not, but that's how seriously I think he takes his job, is when he's locked in, he's laser focused and he's him again. He's in his element. Mamba mentality.
That's fair. I don't know. I missed that. I did chuckle at Russ calling Marty a lying sack of shit as they discussed what happened back in the day. Woody Harrelson is charming as he talks to Lily about getting her house worked on many years ago. Woody, he was great. Like, he was that people person throughout the entire series, and I thought he was great at it. I don't know what it is, but listening to old folks tell stories is such a delight. I didn't steal your words, Dustin. I actually wrote these words in my notes as well, but it's actually funny. But I really didn't need to hear Errol and Betty bumping uglies, but here we are. But funny enough, this isn't even in the top five worst things I've experienced doing these podcasts with these guys. Nitpick I do have with the show, though. But this is a real nitpick I have with the show. But why aren't Papagna and Gilbo shown stalking Marty and Rust? They've established they suspect Rust, but aren't following them any or shown on screen. Like, I really think that's an issue. Like I'm going to use law-abiding citizen as an example. Like, you see Jamie Foxx, like, kind of, like, stalking and, like, researching on Clyde. But, I mean, we see them, like, interviewing and, like, they suspect, like, this shed that, or this, you know, storage building he has, but why don't they stalk him more? Like, I wish they would have shown that. But that's all I got.
So to me, what I took from that is, you know, if it's just a regular citizen, you can probably get away with it. They wouldn't pick up on it. But when you're stalking detectives, if you get caught following someone without, you know, a warrant or probable cause to do it, then Marty and Russ could have got a restraining order for harassment. And so I think that's at least how I justified it in my mind. Cause I did have that same thought. It's like, how did Papagna and, how did Suck and Fuck not realize that they went to the storage shed together? Why weren't they following them? But in my mind, it was that they didn't want to get caught and get a restraining order.
But they didn't have that dog in them like Marty and Russ, though. Like, they were stalking everybody.
He did bring up that he knew that they had gone to the storage shed together.
Yeah.
But I thought the hardest thing for me to believe is that, like we were going back to the storage shed, they're opening it up. If you have any sort of Zoom camera, if you're really spying on someone as a detective, you're going to be able to take pictures of everything in there as soon as that door flies open. And I think that they would know what was in there and what he was doing.
And probably, Russ was caught at the set of the scene. So, I mean, couldn't they have like a probable cause to like want to stalk him to, or like what's going on with this guy?
Possibly. But I mean, if they don't have the okay to do that and they get these pictures from inside and they do end up busting Russ for anything that might have been inadmissible. I don't know. I'm not a cop. I would never be a cop, but that may be inadmissible because, you know, you didn't have a warrant to take those pictures. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, according to this show, the Tuttles run everything, so they figure something out.
That's true. So this is the least amount that I have on any set of scenes as well, but I love how Russ saying, you know, fresh set of eyes, like we're totally green, was like a light bulb moment for Marty. It's not just that he saw the, you know, thought to put the two pictures together, but just like totally green. You know, that was awesome to me. But it was kind of odd that they just now put that together. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong there, because they were looking at these case files years ago, decades ago or whatever. It's just kind of weird that they just now realize green ears. Maybe it's paint. I don't know. Regardless, it's great detective work by Marty. I did get a good chuckle out of Marty having to ask Rust after all this time if he was holding back in their fight. Like, that's egos for you. And again, when Rust said sentient meat and Marty asked, what's scented meat? That's great dialogue. Like, that shit was so funny to me. I love seeing them get closer and closer on the case, tracking down the old lady and finding out it was Childress and son, you know, Childress and son who painted it. That's great shit there. You know, like I said, the puzzle's starting to come together. But then back to the inbred fuck shack. Gross. Thank God it was brief and we didn't go inside that room. Anyway, another great set of scenes here.
Oh, God, that's my nightmare. We open with Russ and Marty on their way to the house. Once there, Rust immediately knows it's the place they've been looking for. Marty goes up to the house to ask to use a phone while Rust looks around. Betty answers, and the conversation turns physical as the dog escapes and is immediately killed off screen when it goes around the house. Marty breaks into the house while Rust inspects the area surrounding the house. He finds the dog dead and stumbles across Errol, who flees into the woods. Back at the house, Marty eventually finds Betty and forces her to give him a phone via gunpoint. Marty exits the house, running, and stumbles across a separate, smaller house, discovering the corpse of Billy Childress. Russ follows Errol through the forest into a labyrinth of tunnels, to which he ventures into alone, and the camera widens on the tunnels to show the true scale of what appears to be an old fort. The tunnels consist of mostly children's clothing, skeletons, and Blair Witch stick figures, while the voice of Errol tells him he's in Carcosa. We quickly cut to Marty as he enters the tunnels and starts yelling for Rust himself. Rust is then shown eventually reaching a room with a big skeleton wearing antlers and starts hallucinating as he starts to see swirling vortex space multiverse of the MCU. While he's distracted, Errol appears and stabs him in the stomach, lifting him off the ground before Rust is able to get away with multiple headbutts as he falls to the ground clutching the knife in his stomach. Marty appears and shoots Errol multiple times, but despite the shots, Errol, throws a roofing hammer at Marty, striking him in the chest. As he prepares to finish Marty off, Errol is killed with a shot to the head by Russ himself. Both heavily bleeding, Marty tends to Russ' wounds as we hear the police arriving to the scene led by Papania and Gilbo. They fire a flare into the air for some reason, and we end the set of scenes with Marty yelling up to the sky to the flare like anybody can hear. Go ahead.
I got the most on this one, and I'm just going to piggyback off my nitpicks from earlier, but I'm not sure why, but Matthew's healthier look with his mustache, it still bothers me. I wish he looked more sickly like earlier. I don't know, that sickly look just fits more with his long hair and the mustache. I know that's a crazy nitpick, but it did stick out to me. Marty, there ain't no way in hell I'm drinking a glass of water from this dump of a house. I know that's just a line to get in, but you got to be believable, brother. Creepy-ass line delivery by Betty saying Billy Childress is all around us. Like, that one got me. I know the animal lovers hated seeing that dead dog in the field. I'm sure they probably didn't think that was necessary, but here we are. Woody and Ann Dow give exceptional performances, especially with their facial acting. And when he draws his gun on her asking for the phone, I thought they were both great. It was horrifying seeing that body out in the shed, cuffed and dead. Ugh. The setting of the showdown I thought was exceptional. I've never seen anything like that fort, like you mentioned, Brian. Normally, I would get annoyed with Russ not hearing Errol's big ass running at him. But like you mentioned, it looked like he was having one of his visions, like from Interstellar, so I can forgive it. Damn, Russ, clubbed in the forearm, stabbed to the gut, and I know them headbutts hurt like hell. I mean, he's got that dog in him. And damn it, Marty, you had clean shots on him and you hit him in the shoulder. Who is this, Harry from Dumb and Dumber shooting at this guy? Goodness gracious. Russ with the hashtag headshot kill on Errol. But damn, that gut wound looks gnarly. I thought this was a good sequence with Errol and the cops, but I will admit I would have liked a little more. You know, maybe Russ pinning Errol and questioning why he did what he did before ending his life. That's something I really do wish would have happened in this scene with Errol and Russ. You know, like all throughout this series, when Russ is interrogating people, he like questions them. Then he like sets them up for like the ultimate like failure or like that ultimate death sentence they're going to get once they get to prison. I wish we would have got Russ questioning Errol before he killed him off. But, you know, still a good set of scenes.
So Marty asking Russ, you still see things? Worth noting to me because it brings up a question I'll save for a little bit later. It is a little convenient that there's no cell signal at the house, but it makes sense because of the rural location, so I'll allow it. Didn't really bother me. Creepy as shit when Errol was standing at the edge of the field when Russ walked around the corner. That's a great shot. They could have shot that so many different ways, but I like how far back it was. You couldn't really make out who it was, but we knew. That was great. The scene really feels like a video game to me. Errol takes off running, so Russ has to chase. Marty is clearing the house and hears Betty giggling and has to follow the sound. And then Russ has to do the same thing with Errol's voice. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it really feels like a video game level to me. The tension's great, and the score has a lot to do with that. So credit to the score there. Okay, so what I said earlier about Marty asking if Russ still sees things, is that what happened with the clouds in the main room of these tunnels here? Like, I'm assuming it is, but
yeah,
to me it was an odd choice because it was brief and it didn't really serve a purpose, really. But, you know, saying that he sees things is one thing, but there hasn't been anything like that in the rest of this show. So it kind of stuck out to me. Russ getting stabbed is a major oh shit moment, as is Marty's shots being, you know, ineffective and getting a hatchet to the chest. Thank God Russ was able to muster his strength to peel Errol's muffin cap back blue. He split his wig. Great shot. Huge sigh of relief when the cavalry arrives, but still great suspense wondering if they both survived or, you know, are they dead? So it leads us to the end. It sets us up nicely. And I will say this. I would not have been surprised at all if they turned the corner and it turns out that the Yellow King was really Maggie Hart. Go ahead.
God. All right, here's the ending. A few days later, Gilbo and Papagna visit Marty at the hospital. They inform him that Errol and Betty were Billy Childress's children, and the tools at his shed matched with the weapons in the Lake Charles and or Lang's murder, effectively closing the case. He is also informed that Russ survived but remains in a coma after surgery. Maggie and his two girls walk in to visit Marty, and he tears up at seeing them, saying he did not expect to see them. Great moment there. We see a media news report on the discovery at the Childress house and how dozens of bodies were discovered at the scene. We are shown Rust as the one watching the report as he falls back asleep. Marty is present at his bedside when Rust wakes up. The two argue, and Rust admits he is disappointed that he couldn't recognize him when he saw Errol at the school in 1995, and is frustrated that they couldn't get everyone responsible held accountable for their actions, namely the Tuttles, although Marty states that their target was just Errol and that they got theirs. Sometime later, a recovered Marty wheels Rust out of the hospital and they both talk in the parking lot as Marty gifts Rust some cigarettes. He expresses that during his coma, he felt happiness knowing that he would soon see his daughter, lamenting that he survived. Marty gives him a pack of cigarettes as he wheels Rust away from the hospital. They both remark on the concept of good and evil and light and darkness, with Rust saying that while there was at one time only darkness, to him, the light appears to be winning.
All right. I thought it was heartwarming to see Maggie and the girls show up in the hospital to visit Marty. And I really appreciated his emotional breakdown at the end of that scene. Good for you, Woody Harrelson. If I had seen the show before Scream 6, I would have been furious. Russ survived, but Chad proved we are capable of surviving anything in these TV and movie programs. Jeez, so, right. You know, I'll give Russ a pass.
Catch us.
I got a good chuckle out of this exchange of dialogue. I'll come by tomorrow. And Russ says, why? Like, damn, Russ, are y'all not friends yet? Like, have y'all not? Y'all still arguing? And I wrote, of course, Russ smokes camels. Over the course of the season, he smoked 49 cigarettes and drank 8 beers on camera. I thought that was a really fascinating scene. I thought that was a really fascinating fact. Matthew, he gives another great monologue as he talks about being under in the darkness and his daughter's love. I thought he did a great job there. I thought it was a solid ending to a phenomenal TV series.
All right. Great relief when we hear that Russ is alive, but still stressful finding out he's still in a coma. It's kind of odd that only one of Marty's daughters came to visit him, especially when there was another girl with her. Who the hell was that? Was that supposed to be his other daughter? Because it's a completely different actress. They didn't even look like her. So, Nico, you said his girls came to see him, but I don't know who the hell that other girl was supposed to be.
That's still not the girl that played her in Walking Dead? That's not the same
actress? No, that was a different girl altogether.
I didn't notice. I just noticed Starlight. I didn't notice her.
Yeah. To be honest. So, but Russ wakes up and we hear the news about the Tuttles and everything is good in the world, or at least Louisiana. So that's a nice touch there. Russ telling Marty that he saw Errol in 95. Yeah, no shit. Like I said, that bothers me. His face was dirty, but to me, he still would have seen the scars, man. He was too close. I like the line from the dialogue about the dark and the light and who's winning. But to me, I feel like they shot their load a little early in this finale. Like the climax happened with like 20 minutes left in the episode. And we got a lot of filler nature shots before we get here. And then the rest is just kind of anticlimactic conversation between the two. That's kind of how I feel about this episode in general. Not bad by no means, but I kind of feel like the first 7 episodes were so much better, so much more tension and drama. And I just wanted more. I don't know. I don't know what more, but I just feel like I wanted more. Feel a little unfulfilled with the ending.
I get that. And my only thing here with this episode is, is a nitpick of mine too. I think Glenn Fletcher, who plays Errol, fantastic in his role. Definitely 100% looks the part. They did great. But he's described from everyone as being super tall. And that wasn't the case to me. And that stood out to me. Even in the fight where they tried to make him look a little taller than Matthew McConaughey, he wasn't super tall to me. He looked short.
Yeah. So when reality, he's only like 6 foot tall or something. And so they had to really rely on angles in that final shot to make him look taller than he was. But yeah, I agree. I don't think that they could have just left out the part about him being tall, because he's still an imposing figure being as fat as he is. So I don't know.
And the scars. Yeah. I mean, that's imposing. That's scary.
Yeah. But overall, as far as the finale, like I said, I gave them all an individual rating. It wasn't bad, but to me, I felt so unfulfilled that I gave it an 8. Still solid, though.
Oh, wow.
I mean, 8 still good, especially from Dustin.
9.5 on IMDb. That's crazy.
Yeah. The acting was great. It's just I felt like it was kind of – it happened too quickly. I would have rather they stretch it out and, you know, we don't get all that conversation at the end, the feel-good stuff, which it was phenomenal. Writing, the acting, the dialogue was all great. But I kind of just wish that it ended right after the cops arrive. We flash to the hospital for maybe a minute or two, and then we're out. But we got 20 minutes of that.
I get that. And I also think that if, you know, you could have stretched it out a little bit longer, like brought the heroes down a little bit, had them maybe caught by you know, Errol and tortured for a little while before maybe they escape, maybe they kill him. I don't know, you know, have them suffer a little bit more. But then you think about it and like, fuck, that's all they've done all season is beat these two characters down to the fucking ground. Like, and that's it. So it was nice to see a little bit of redemption.
Or maybe something else that I would have been okay with is Detective Suck and Fuck, like impeding the event. Like they catch them, they stop them before they even get to Errol's and just draw that out. Make them look like, no, we've got you. We got a warrant. Yep. We went into your shed and we found all this evidence. You're going down. And so they have to shake them and still end up catching them. Something.
Yeah, Gilbo and Papagni just had like, they weren't bad actors, but they just had no charisma to them. Like there was nothing special about them.
I did like his, I don't remember the line, but when he's meeting with Papagni there and he says something about white man, like that shit was funny to me. I don't remember the exact line he delivered.
Speaking in riddles, white man.
Yeah, that shit was funny.
I guess it's easy to say in hindsight, but I do really wish like Russ would have like, I wish he would have gotten to like torture Errol like he did like the other people he interrogated. Like he was a dick to that guy whenever he's talking about like, yeah, it's probably your fault that your wife got killed because you showed him the pictures. You know, he got the confession out of the pharmacist and then he's like, eh, you probably want to kill yourself. They don't treat child killers good. And like, I wish we would have got that. And like, he just like, I wish we would have seen all his anger come out on Errol. Yeah. I wanted to see more of that dark edge from him. But yeah. But he has an interstellar moment and gets his ass beat a little bit. But you know, it's still a good show. Still a really good show.
Something I do want to say is how great they did with Errol. I mean, yeah, they've got all season of buildup, but we don't see him and interacting with anything and just how fucking disgusting he is until this episode at the beginning. And it takes, I mean, they build him up to such a fucking bad guy in such a short time. Like, you hate him. Like, as soon as you like interact with him, and is it Becky, whatever that girl's name is at the beginning. And it's just, I think they did such a good job writing with that.
Oh, yeah, like all throughout, calling like the Yellow King. I thought, it was great. It was great.
I've got some fun facts. I've got a handful here, and they're about the season in general, so they're not necessarily about these episodes, but I saved them for this. So to prepare, Matthew McConaughey created a 450-page analysis called The Four Stages of Rustin Cole to study his character's evolution over the course of the story. That is dedication.
Yeah.
According to show creator Nick Pizzolatto, all of the nude scenes in season one were pay cable mandated, and that he would have been happy with no nudity. That was interesting. Speaking of, when Alexandra Daddario heard that President Barack Obama had ordered a copy of the show's first season, which features her completely nude, she tweeted, "The president has seen my boobs." That made me laugh.
Jesus.
That made me laugh. Nick Pizzolatto contemplated another ending for season one, in which Marty and Russ didn't leave the maze and were never heard from again. But in the end, he decided to give them a happy ending. I don't know. That might have worked for me. That might have, tension. Ugh. Tension, man.
It would have eaten me alive. No way. I couldn't have dealt with that one.
Well, especially, with it being an anthology series and season two's not related. And I don't even know at this point if season two was even a thing, because it was intended to be like a miniseries originally. But I get that. And then last one I've got, season one is considered a part of Cthulhu mythos, a literary subgenre that comes from the works of H.P. Lovecraft. The original description of Errol Childress, the green-eared spaghetti monster, is a reference to Lovecraft's monster Cthulhu. There are also multiple references to Robert W. Chambers' collection of short stories, The King in Yellow. These include Carcosa, The Yellow King, and Black Stars. Much like Nick Pizzolatto, Lovecraft was heavily influenced by The King in Yellow. So, theoretically, if this is part of Lovecraft lore, then Rust and Cole, they exist in the same universe as Nick Cage in The Color Out of Space, or whatever that movie was called.
Well, and whenever he saw that space bullshit in the caves, he was hallucinating. That's the first thing I thought about, was like, that's the only Lovecraftian thing of this entire movie to me, and that made me think of that fucking Nick Cage movie that we watched. Thanks, Sean.
Yeah. I don't know if we've said these throughout this review, but I just thought it was interesting. According to Matthew McConaughey, the entirety of Russ Cole's interview scenes were shot in one day. This means about 28 pages of a 450-page season, one script, were filmed over the course of an 18-hour workday. God, that's impressive as hell. That's impressive as hell.
I would have needed much more than that six-pack of Lone Star that he drank.
Well, just to memorize that much. Holy shit.
Man, Matthew killed this role. Like, he was super dedicated. I can't compliment him enough. The episodes averaged 11.2 million viewers, making it the most watched first season of an HBO original series since Band of Brothers in 2001. Another very impressive. This is interesting. Russ Cole was based on a high school teacher in Arkansas who also worked on the police force.
Wow.
All righty. I only got two more. In the first season, Matthew McConaughey plays an atheist while Woody Harrelson plays a Christian. In reality, their worldviews are reversed, with McConaughey being the Christian, Harrelson being the atheist. It's weird that brothers have such unique or such differing religious views.
Yeah, I saw that when I left it off, because I didn't want to think about, no offense, like, believe what you want to believe, but Woody Harrelson's one of my favorite actors, and I didn't want to think about us being on opposing sides of religion thought, so...
Dang, I'm sorry. Cut that, Brian. Cut that one.
No, it's all good. It's all good.
And the last one I got is Christian Bale and Jessica Chastain were pursued for lead roles in the second season of the show, but both passed on the project due to the significant time commitment the show would have required. Doesn't season two have Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams?
Yes, sir.
I mean, don't get me wrong, they're good, but Bale and Chastain?
And no, dude.
Bale and Chastain would have been fired.
Listen, I love Christian Bale. Colin Farrell is one of my favorite actors, though. Like, Colin Farrell is the only reason I watched The Killing of a Sacred Deer. I do regret that decision, but I love Colin Farrell. So, I'm going to watch season two.
What about The Lobster? You liked that one, didn't you?
God damn.
The Lobster, man, that movie was entertaining. It was so fucking weird. That's one of those A24 movies that Brian will want to shoot himself after watching.
And I'm sure you'll pick it sometime soon.
I'm sure you will, exactly. Let's not pick good A24 movies. I want Brian to fucking watch this one.
It is a good movie. It's quirky.
Oh, Jesus. Anybody, you guys want to give our final ratings on the show?
Let's do it.
Announce what we're doing?
I'll go ahead and go first then. Yeah, so like I said, I really enjoy this show. I think that the acting and the writing is top-notch. And through 7.5 episodes, really, it was just compelling television. It's just that last 20 minutes kind of lost me a little. I didn't really care for it as much. Hot take, I've said this with you guys. I don't mean any offense. I'm not taking anything away from the show. I didn't really feel like it was much horror. I felt like it, you know, it's more cop drama, but it was still phenomenal, and I'm glad we reviewed it.
Whoa! As many times as you called Maggie a whore, you don't think that this movie is horror?
Horror.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. There are horrors and horror, but they're not mutually exclusive. no, I'm glad we reviewed it. So I'm not. I don't want to be taken that way. It's a great pick, Brian. It's just you know, to me, I wasn't scared of anything. If I was a lot younger, I would have been. If I was one of their, you know, the Yellow King's targets. But anyway, I gave a individual score for each episode. And when you average those out, we got a perfect rating. Like it's no decimal point.
Thanks.
Gave a 9. Gave a 9 out of 10.
Man, great show, Brian. I knew I'd love it, but I'm glad we reviewed it on here. And, you know, Dustin may not think it's horror, but I always think true crime kind of falls in that horror genre. You know, maybe one of them subgenres. I know a lot of horror fans are true crime fans as well. I want to go perfect 10, but I do have like a little bit of a letdown with the grand finale. So I gave it a 9.5. It's damn near perfect. I'm definitely planning on rewatching this show once every 2 years, once a year, maybe. Like, I really liked it. It was good.
I did, before you go, Brian, I did like you said true crime, and it reminded me, that was a great line from Marty when he was trying to talk his way into seeing those case files and everything. He's like, true crime, that's the genre, not the title. Like, that was funny.
Oh, that joke he told at the beginning of that. I'm not gonna mention that, but that shit was funny.
Oh, no, I'll say it was funny. It's like, what do you call it? What do you call a black pilot? A pilot, you racist fuck. Like, that's a good joke.
It was a dad joke, but it's not. I mean, it was a little bit worse. It got me.
Yeah.
Mine's going to be easy. I mean, you mentioned, Dustin, that it not scaring you. I said at the beginning of this that, or the beginning of the, when we started doing the whole series, when I talked about me picking it to begin with, it did scare me. Like, it's something that stuck with me. I dreamed about it. And again, I don't know if it's because I binged the series and it was just stuck in my head. I thought about it for days after. Like, and that's because of the realism. There are sick fucks like this out there, and that, you know, shit, it, there's nothing more scary than real life. And so I gave this a 10.
Okay. So that gives us a composite score of a 9.5. IMDb for season one alone has it at a 9.225. So we're right there with it.
Hell yeah. Great series. I loved it. Definitely plan on watching it again. It was definitely one of those shows where I'd watch like the two episodes that we had to do for the week. And I was like, fuck it, let's ball. Let's just keep watching. You know, I had a great time with it. Y'all got any final thoughts on True Detective before I announce my next series pick?
No, I do want to hear your thoughts on the other series. I haven't seen season 3 of True Detective, and I haven't seen the 4th one, the brand new one. So I, of course, Nick Pezzolatto didn't have anything to do with the 4th one. So I don't know. It's interesting. If you guys watch the series or watch any other seasons, let me know.
I did hear that season 4 is absolute dog water, but
really,
that's just what I heard. And I think, you were right about, yeah, Vince Vaughn's in season 2. It's Mahershala Ali is in season 3, which is the one I'm looking most forward to out of the remaining series because I love him. He's phenomenal.
All right, I'll go ahead and announce my next series pick. I'm excited to review it just because it's a really fun series. I know Brian's been talking to us about wanting to watch some American Horror Story. So I'm going to pick American Horror Story 1984. The only really qualm, it's not even a qualm, but I don't know if you get that true, authentic American Horror Story feel because there's no Jessica Lange, Sarah Paulson, or Evan Peters, but Emma Roberts, she's a star. She's awesome. This is a throwback slasher series, and it is fun. I had a great time with it. And I'm excited to review it. And I'm excited for Brian to watch his first series of American Horror Story. So that's going to be our next one.
I'm excited for that too.
Brian, I'm really glad you picked True Detective. It was great. It was really good.
Me too.
We appreciate y'all listening. I hope we brought something to it, even though the YouTube comments said we didn't. thank y'all for listening. Just want to remind everybody.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.